Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we talked to a music journalist who has profiled some of the greatest legends in music, including Johnny Cash, Chuck Berry, Ray Charles, and Elvis Costello.
That's right. Every day he writes the book. All right, Patrick, it's always fun when we have an interview.
Yes, it always is.
On the show, and you're going to get that today and tomorrow here on Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And who did we talk to?
Well, we talked to Peter Guralnick, Jim, one of the foremost authors of American roots and vernacular music that there is, maybe the preeminent one. I mean, he's interviewed everybody, as you'll hear, and he's got a new book.
He does, and he's going to talk about that. It's a sort of a compilation book where he's presenting a lot of profiles of people he has interviewed over the years. Some giants in the music industry, you're going to hear some big names. And then also some people who maybe aren't as well known, but he feels are important and people that you should know about. So anyway, we'll let him describe the book and talk about the book. Just letting everyone out there know that the interview is in two parts. So you're going to hear part one today. Part two tomorrow. I think if you are at all a fan of American music, this is a conversation I think you're going to really get something out of.
Absolutely.
All right. So with that, let's roll tape on the interview.
Hard times in every where you go. Times are harder than ever been before.
Okay, Patrick, this is a real treat. We're getting talk again with our old friend. Let's just call him our old friend, Peter Guralnick. And we met him before when we were at the old show at USA Today, and we interviewed him about his book on Sam Phillips a few years ago, and he has a new book out now called Looking to Get Lost, and it's all about sort of his adventures in music writing. And welcome to our new show, Peter.
Well, I have to say I had a great time the last time, and I'm expecting to have just as good a time this time.
Thank you, Peter. We really appreciate you coming on. And Jim, I'll say one thing really quick. You know, you said we met Peter at USA Today, and we did. You know, we met him in person and got to chat with him, which was amazing. But it's so strange to me interviewing a writer that you love so much, because you feel like you already know a lot about that person, you know, and suddenly they're stepping in the flesh. And so it's a real treat to talk to Peter again.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get right at this. The new book is a number of profiles, remembrances, you know, sort of look back at different people you've interviewed or gotten to know or tried to sort of explain their personalities, their works, things like that. But the first thing I found really interesting was just in the introduction to the book about your own career, your own journey as a music writer, which is that when you got started and you wanted to write about the blues, there weren't places really to do that in the United States, right? Yeah. Like, it seems so foreign today with the mass of like entertainment and pop culture news outlets that we have. But what was it like when you were starting out?
Well, I mean, I never imagined writing about the music. I wanted to be a writer, but I fell into the blues when I was about 15 or 16. And it was really the opportunity that presented itself. It wasn't that I went seeking the opportunity because it didn't exist. But a friend of mine, a kid I knew, started Crawdaddy magazine. And he was at college. He was a few years younger than I was, Paul Williams.
Yeah.
And this was the second shot that I had. See, everybody who knew me knew that I was crazy about, obsessive about, nuts about, and insistent upon the blues. And so they would come and say, how would you like to write something? I mean, he did, as did another friend of mine at Boston After Dark, which started just about the same time, a little later. And I had a friend who was a drama critic there. And they both came to me and said, how would you like to write something? And I said, great. But, you know, neither publication was focused on the blues or rhythm and blues or anything like that. I mean, in the case of Crawdaddy, they were more like psychedelic rock, Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, Moby Grape, stuff like that. And I said, well, I want to write about Skip James or Robert Peter Williams or Muddy Waters in Howlin' Wolf when it came to the Boston After Dark. And I thought, well, that's it. You know, they won't be interested. And they said, great. You know, in the case of the Boston After Dark, I think they needed content because essentially they were an advertising venue. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's what I did. I mean, there I am. I think the first thing I wrote for Crawdaddy was about Skip James. And there's Skip James in the midst of all this, you know, San Francisco, you know, rock. So it was just a terrific opportunity, and it was thrilling to me. I mean, writing for the Boston After Dark, which became the Phoenix, to be able to just set down the names of Howlin' Wolf, of Muddy Waters, of James Brown, of Jerry Lewis, to put them in print, Big Joe Turner, because there hadn't been anything like that in my experience. And so I started out in that, and then I just had to find a voice of my own.
What was it that attracted you to that particular music? Like you said, at a time when maybe it was kind of out of fashion or kind of coming in and out of fashion or having little bits of appreciation revivals, but still maybe not what the other people your age at the time might have been interested in. What was it about the blues that hooked you?
You know, if I could describe that, I would have the key to the universe, but I don't know. It had nothing to do with fashion. It simply was below the radar, below the surface. Nobody was paying much attention to it. When I say nobody, clearly, there were people, and there was, without an internet, you didn't know who else was out there. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, for example, when I bought the Robert Johnson album, I was a freshman in college. I was 17 years old. It was the fall of 61. I had no sense that this was going to happen. I mean, this was coming out. In Robert Johnson, there were like maybe one or two cuts available on LPs that Sam Charters had put out. And so I go in, I see this Robert Johnson, King of the Delta Blues Singers, and I take it back to my dorm room and I listened over and over and over and over. I mean, I was just so enthralled and I was just so caught up in it, as I had been in the music at that point for a couple of years. When I was writing my book, Searching for Robert Johnson, I got in touch with Columbia and I said, well, how many did this King of the Delta Blues Singers, this acknowledged classic, how many did it sell, let's say, in the first 10 years? And it sold about 15,000 copies worldwide. Well, I've come to the conclusion that I've probably met all 15,000 people who bought, you know, the record. But the point is, I didn't know who else was listening to it. You know, in England, Eric Clapton picked it up.
Right.
You know, Mick Jagger picked it up. Keith Richards picked it up. So it's not as if there wasn't a community. It's just you didn't know the community existed. And my first inkling of that community was when I became aware of the magazine Blues Unlimited, which was the first and one of the best of all the blues magazines. And it was 28A, I think, Bexhill-on-Sea, and I forget the rest of the address. And I read about it in a column by Nat Hentoff in The Reporter. And I wrote to them. And that was really the first I became aware that anybody was out there doing this kind of thing. There were all these jazz publications. I mean, so I was aware that there were things that were close to the same thing, but, you know, not what I was passionate about.
And Peter, one of my favorite anecdotes, I think I had this right, was it that magazine, Blues Incorporated, that you told someone you were going to do an interview for that magazine, but you'd actually never read it, not because you didn't want to, you'd already sent away for it. And the person you were interviewing said, oh, well, it's amazing. They want to do another one after they just ran a three-part series.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
That was incredible.
I'd had this correspondence. This was in 63, 64. And so I was 19, 20 years old. And I'd had this correspondence going with the two editors of Blues Unlimited, Simon Napier and Mike Ledbetter.
Yeah.
And we had this great correspondence. We were going back and forth. And I sent them my check for the subscription. And I never got a copy.
Right.
Then I saw Skip James at Newport in 64 and just was blown away. And in 65, the summer of 65, he was staying with Dick Waterman, who became a very good friend and has been, you know, the best of friends for 60 years almost.
Yeah.
And Skip was playing at Club 47 and staying with Dick Waterman. So I called up Dick. You know, I felt no sense of standing. I felt like, you know, who's this kid calling up and stuff? I thought to myself, well, Blues Unlimited, if they ever send me a copy, I know they'd love this. I mean, from my correspondence. So I say to Dick, you know, I want to do this story for Blues Unlimited. And Dick is a very polite person. And he said, that's interesting. You know, I'm surprised they want to do another story about him after they just finished a three-part series. So I quickly, you know, reconnoitered or you look for a fallback position. And I had also just started being in touch with another British blues magazine, Blues World, which Bob Groom edited. I've never met Bob Groom. I never met any of the editors. I wish I had.
Yeah.
But Bob Groom, I stay in touch with to this day. And so I pitched the idea to him. But really, I didn't have anything to pitch. I just felt, I've used this phrase, and maybe you can tell me where it came from, but I just felt like greatness such as this will not pass my way again. And I just felt compelled. It's like what Sam Phillips said about starting a studio. I mean, on a much more modest scale in my case. But it was just, I felt like if I didn't have the courage to do this, I'd be the greatest coward on God's green earth. That's right. What Sam said about starting the studio. And so I just felt compelled to do it, which is the same reason that in 63, 2 years earlier, I had sought out the English novelist Henry Green.
Right.
And I was just completely consumed with his writing. I had read all 9 of his novels. I had read his autobiography, Pack My Bag. I had read them, some of them twice. And when I was in England, and I wrote to him and I said, you know, would he see me? And he says, by all means, come ahead. You know, so boring around here. And I was just so scared, both with Henry Green and with Skip James. It's as if you have a third hand or third arm to push you through the door.
Right.
And I thought I was going to throw up, you know.
Right.
But
right.
I did it because I just felt compelled to.
Well, Peter, you're giving away all the great stories in the book. No, I'm just kidding, folks. This is like 3 pages he's talking about here. This is how great this book
is. Let me retract all that and just say, if you want to find out about that, read the book.
Just tantalize.
I just want to say real quick, I found it quite charming in a way, being a journalist, you know, myself over all these many years, is that idea that, you know, you got nervous too. Like, we've all been through that, right? Everybody's sort of been scared to death.
We're still going through it, right?
Yeah, right.
Yes.
And that was my next question. Did that ever dissipate, or did you continue to get nervous interviewing some of these, you know, music legends over the years?
You know, it dissipated to a degree. I mean, I'm not quaking in my boots as I talk to you, which I might once have done.
But like Johnny Cash, for example, that would probably be an intimidating experience, right?
You know, not so much, no. Okay. I mean, I wanted it to be fun. I want the book to be fun. I mean, I think the book is sort of a plum pudding, and I want everybody to stick in their thumb and take out whatever they want from it. Same with the Sam Phillips biography. But the thing is that I take it seriously, and I try to prepare as best I can. But what I want to do is to have a conversation with someone, and I want to talk to them on the level. I mean, I don't want to go in there and, you know, say, oh, woe is me, poor me, you know. I wanted to talk to them, and by being as prepared as I could be. Now, in many cases, I couldn't be prepared because somebody like Dan Penn, for example, when I first interviewed him, I don't know if anything had been written about him. When I wrote about somebody like D. Ford Bailey, played the harmonica on the Grand Ole Opry, the first black star of any kind, you know, I just couldn't find much about him. And so I just went in as much, you know, with whatever I could. But with Johnny Cash, I wanted to talk to him. I don't want to say as an equal, because I'm not trying to lift myself up in some, but I didn't want to talk to himself like some poor, pathetic person. And so we really had a conversation. And one of the things that I went in there with the idea of doing, I mean, this is Johnny Cash is in the book, as you say.
Yep.
But I asked him, I knew he was a great reader. And I said, you know, I know you've been a great reader all your life. What kind of books did you read as a kid? And he said, you know, Ivanhoe and James Fenimore Cooper and Drums Along the Mohawk. And we started talking. And that brought out his talking about the day that Eleanor Roosevelt came to town, to Dyess, which was a kind of socialist experiment in Arkansas that had been set up by the Roosevelt administration, where everybody lived on barter and sort of on an equal basis. And he said, you know, he said he just would never forget. It was one of the most exciting events when Eleanor Roosevelt came to town to dedicate the library. And he talked about that. It wasn't that the story was going to be about the Dyess Library or about, you know, James Fenimore Cooper or anything, but it gave me a window into talking to him about something he was passionate about. And so the pressure was not so much on me. So I go out of every interview. I still do, you know, just flailing myself for all the things that I didn't ask or the stupid way I put this question or something like that. So in that sense, it's carried over. But mainly, I really do want to talk to the people I talk to, many of whom, you know, would subsequently became friends and friends for life.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but many. But I want to talk to them, you know, on as equal a basis as I can in what amounts to a conversation, not where I'm in awe of something. I mean, I'm not interested in talking from outside. I want to tell the story that I'm telling about them. The profile I write, I really want to be from the inside out as much as possible, and I wanted to portray their world to the fullest extent that I'm capable of.
That's beautifully said, Peter. And I would love to hear about the first time you got interviewed. Like, when was the first time someone came to you and said, oh, Peter Guralnick's a well-known author now, I want to interview them, and suddenly you were on the other side. Like, what was that like?
You know, I don't know, but I'll tell you one thing was when Sweet Soul Music came out.
Yep.
That was really the first time I did any kind of a book tour. I did it on my own. I did it with a friend of mine named Mark Pucci, who's a publicist in Atlanta, who worked for Capricorn for many years.
Yeah.
A good friend. And we set it up and we went out. We did it in Macon. We did it in Nashville. We did it in Memphis, you know, essentially the Mid-South, the subject, you know, where the book took place.
You just called up bookstores and said, hey, we'll come in and...
No. Mark was much better connected than that.
Oh, okay.
And there wouldn't have been any point going to bookstores, which this is the payoff, is that we made the front page and make.
Wow.
We were on the best. I mean, when I say we, I'm including Mark. Great publicity. Mark did an incredible job. There wasn't a single book to be had anywhere that I went. I mean, the publisher, you know, said, oh, that's very nice. You're going off and doing this little thing. You know, we did a thing in Muscle Shoals. I mean, there weren't a lot of bookstores in Muscle Shoals.
but you couldn't buy the book.
No, you couldn't buy the book. But you asked me about being interviewed.
Yeah.
Towards the end of that, in the summer of 86, Good Morning America got in touch. Oh. I was running a camp at the time. I directed a boys' camp in New Hampshire for 22 years, and my grandfather had started, which is also in the book.
Yep.
But I don't want to say too much about it. You have to read the book.
Yeah.
Right. But, there you go.
But anyway, so Good Morning America got in touch with me, and I don't know what I was thinking. I never left camp. I mean, this was one of the two times. The only other time I left camp was for Charlie Rich. But, right, what can you do? But I don't know what I was thinking, but I said, fine, I'll do your piddling little show. I mean, I didn't say it arrogantly. I say, if you have Solomon Burke on.
Mm.
And that's what happened.
Wow, that's a great condition. Yeah.
Then I began to think, oh God, Solomon is just going to roll right over me. He's so colorful, he's so funny. But he was unbelievably considerate. This was a case where I really thought I was going to throw up. We were back in the green room with a Russian comedian named Smirnoff.
Yakov Smirnoff, yeah.
Yes. And Solomon was just being hilarious. And I'm thinking, I don't know if I can go out on stage. So that was my introduction to sort of the formal interview. And the second time was at the beginning of the Last Train to Memphis tour in 94. Mm-hmm. And then this was a real tour. I mean, Mark Pucci set up a real tour, but there were actually books on the Last Train tour.
Right.
And I did Conan's show.
Wow.
And that was a thing where I'm backstage. I'm with my daughter, Nina, who was a freshman at Barnard, and somehow or other, she had been given the task of minding me. I mean, everybody else in the publicity department was busy that night. And so she took me. And that was another case where I'm backstage and all I could think about was, I'm going to walk out on stage. I'm going to trip and fall. Everybody's going to laugh at me. But that was the last time I was nervous.
Wow.
I mean, I have no way to explain it. I'm not exaggerating how sick to my soul I was.
Yeah.
Not to mention, maybe I thought I was going to be sick to my stomach. The Solomon thing, I can't believe I actually got out there. Solomon was so unbelievably supportive and thoughtful, and he had his crown with him. So he sat on the couch. This was another thing which I thought, okay, I don't care where it goes. At least Solomon's here. I achieved that. But he sat there very meekly. He was meek in his interview with the crown there. And finally, the host says, and I see you have your crown with you. And he put on the crown. He talked about it. Those were the two standout moments,
right,
in terms of,
totally,
oh my God, what am I doing here?
That's got to be on YouTube somewhere, right, Jim?
Probably. Quick question I have. I wonder if you have any insight on Solomon Burke in this regard, which is, why is he not a bigger, better known sort of legend today? You know, there are others of his contemporaries that I think are more sort of household names, but people don't know Solomon Burke so much, even though people who are in the know just revere him, right? Why is there some disconnect?
Well, yeah, I mean, the first time that I saw Solomon Burke was at the Summer Shower of Stars Soul Review in the summer of 64. And he was headlining a show with Otis Redding, Joe Tex, Rufus Thomas, Sugar Pie DeSanto, Garnett Mims, but he was the headliner.
Right.
And there was absolutely no question who took the show. I mean, Otis Redding was good, but Solomon was in total command. And I never saw anybody take a show from him. I mean, never saw anybody surpass him. Solomon just was dominant, and nobody was funnier, nobody was wittier, nobody was more entertaining, nobody was more profound, and nobody could reach an audience the way that he did. Joe Tex had an incredibly warm personality and drew people in. James Brown could just blow people away, and I never saw the two of them together, and I don't know what the result of that would have been. each of them had their own story about how they just absolutely blew the other one away. You know, I don't know about that. But no, I don't know why it is. I think that audiences, particularly audiences from, let's say, a different culture, from a majoritarian culture, for want of a better word, pick someone who can stand for being the one.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there isn't room for two. There's room for one.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's the person who is most accommodating to their desires, their interests, and stuff like that. But if you went into the Black community, if you saw Solomon, not just in his heyday, and forget about the Black community, he's all around the world. You saw him, you know, playing in Italy. There's nobody who could, you know, win an audience over or present something more profound or more entertaining or often even just more funny than Solomon. He was just an astonishing, and I would say of all the people I've ever met, in, at least in this regard, Solomon Burke and Sam Phillips were the most charismatic.
Mm.
And then I introduced them to each other. Solomon came all the way across the country for the book release party for Sweet Soul Music.
Did he
in 86.
Really? Wow.
So he said, maybe he was living next door, you know, but no, he came with a woman who was driving him, who was an undertaker in Baltimore, driving one of his Lincolns that his church had for him. And he came and Sam Phillips came and, you know, two of my greatest heroes. And I introduced them. And they just, their eyes just, they just locked each other in their stares. I mean, they just stared at each other. And there was no love lost between them. And I have no idea to this day what it was. And I'm saying, oh, you know, I'm trying to make it easier. I'm saying, you know, the two of you started out in the same business. You were both in the funeral business. Not a thing, not a blink, not nothing. So, and I've got a picture of the two of them eyeing each other in the Sam Phillips biography,
yep,
taken by Pat Rayner, a wonderful, yep, Memphis, yep, photographer. How does that happen? You introduce your two best friends and they just stare at each other until one of them looks away, and neither of them looked away.
Okay, so let's take a pause here on the interview.
Okay.
We will pick it up with more with Peter Guralnick tomorrow. Of course, as you mentioned, the book is Looking to Get Lost, and that's available now, right? It's out now. You can go, yeah, purchase that.
You can. And, you know, Peter has written a lot of books, as you may know, including the definitive one on Elvis Presley and also on Sam Phillips. So, you know, the amount of research he has done into this area just kind of boggles my mind. And also that he retains so much of it,
right,
you know, when he remembers all those things. It's really, really impressive.
All right. Let's get on to here. We will present part two of our interview with Peter Guralnick tomorrow on the show. Also, a quick note here. It is still not too late if you want to get your 2020 favorite song and or album recordings, mm-hmm, into us. You can we're going to start that series in a couple of days here, but you know, we'll still be putting it together and it should run for some time. So
yeah,
tell us about your favorite album or song from 2020. You can call, the number is 612-440-1984. Leave a message there, or if you would rather, you can like record a voice memo and email that to rock@suburbspod.com.
Right.
And in return, you'll get a mix CD, mm-hmm, in the mail. All right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
You know you say you had money. You better be sure. Don't these hard times gonna kill you. Just drive along so. Oh, 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 oh.
Damn.
Old men clearing their throat.
I tell you, man, I got to get my act together.